From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2000, Daniel Suelo took all the money he had left in the world out of his pocket. It was 30 bucks. He set it inside a phone booth and he walked away. The writer Mark Sundin has written a book about Suelo, who has managed to live principally in caves in the canyons near Arches National Park for the last 12 years without taking or receiving or spending a single dime. Today in the program, Mark Sundin will join us. Daniel Suelo will too. We'll talk about how you manage to live a life, a happy, healthy existence without money. Sundin's book traces the path of Suelo's life, his extreme lifestyle, his philosophy behind it, but it also explores his own feelings about the things in life that really matter. The book is called The Man Who Quit Money. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here are the first few lines of Mark Sundin's book. In the first year of the 21st century, a man standing by a highway in the middle of America pulled from his pocket his life savings, $30. He laid it inside a phone booth and he walked away. For 12 years now, Daniel Suelo has lived his life without credit or barter or government handouts, without money. Mark Sundin's book traces the path of Suelo's life, his extreme lifestyle, his philosophy that comes behind it, but he also explores his own feelings about the things that in life that really matter. Mark Sundin is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called The Man Who Quit Money. Mark Sundin is the author of a number of books, including Car Camping and The Making of Toro. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Believer, McSweeney's, and Outside Magazine. And he's joining us here in the studio. Mark Sundin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to start with how you met Daniel, first of all, because you write about this in the book. You knew him before he had ditched the idea of money.
Yeah. I'd met him almost 20 years ago down in Moab.
Right.
And we were working together as cooks in a restaurant. And we'd had a similar life, I would say, in that we'd both been to college and had ideas of a career. He'd actually been in the Peace Corps as well. He's a few years older than me. But we didn't see anything we wanted to do as a career. We didn't want to, you know, climb the ladder, join the rat race. And so we'd gone to Moab, which, is, as you probably know, is a great place to lose your ambition for a while.
So so even then, you shared a kind of connection. I mean, how do you explain the relationship that you have with him? Kindred spirits, sort of?
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting part, of course, is that we were leading a pretty similar life back then. I was living in my car. Daniel was eventually decided to live in a cave one summer because he didn't want to pay rent. And, you know, we've diverged pretty drastically since then.
There's a story you tell. You encountered him, so he went off on his way. You went off on your way, and at some point you encountered him again in Moab. You say you barely recognized him at first. He had bad teeth, and you say that made you ashamed, and a sentiment which you say in the book made you mad.
Yeah, I had heard from mutual friends that Daniel had stopped using money. And I thought, oh, well, he obviously just went crazy because why else would anyone stop using money?
Yeah.
And then I ran into him one day somewhere in Moab, and I had kind of repressed this memory until I started writing the book, but it was there like a thorn in my side or in my shoe. And finally it came back to me, and I'd seen him across this a market, and I kind of looked at him. He looked like he'd aged. His hair was gray. You know, I hadn't seen him in years. He had a gray beard, and he used to be very clean shaven. And he smiled at me, and he was missing a tooth. And I immediately basically turned away and walked out of the store as if I didn't know him, didn't even acknowledge him. And, you know, this is something I'm not really proud of because I like to think of myself as a good person who's nice to everyone, even if they have a tooth missing. But I realized that knowing he lived without money and then seeing him, I thought, you know, what right does he have to have bad teeth in America? This is the richest country in the history of civilization. And when I saw that, it felt like, you know, I was ashamed that of how much I had and that I have really good teeth. And, you know, maybe I was doing something wrong, but I didn't want to think about it. And I felt mad at him, and I just walked out of the store.
What do you make of that? I have to say your reaction is similar to there's an article about the book in The Atlantic.
Yeah, that's an excerpt.
In The Atlantic. And going through some of the comments are really interesting because they reflect in some ways the way you were – a part anyway of what you were feeling. Let me read some of these because I think they're interesting. Not practical at all and seems pretty pointless. His existence seems subsidized by freeloading on others. The guy is a glorified leech. And it kind of goes on and on like that. Celebrating someone who runs away from life is not something that I would do. They say he might as well jump off a cliff or go into the wilderness and starve himself to death like Chris McCandless, which was the character real-life person that chronicled in Jon Krakauer's book. But what do you make of that kind of reaction? People are pretty passionate about this. They're pretty dismissive. But do you sense the kind of anger that you were feeling at that time?
You know, now that I know Daniel well, it blows me away, and I feel pain that people are judging him so quickly. But I know that I did the same at one point in my life, and so I can kind of relate to these people. But nonetheless, I am just amazed at the amount of anger and fear that he inspires in people who I would probably get along with. I mean, I've been talking about Daniel to people who were, you know, Peace Corps volunteers, the type of people I think who would really
relate to it.
People who've spent time in the third world, people who've lived with less, and they say, well, what's he giving back? Mm. You know, what is he contributing to society? Mm. And how dare he? And it's amazing. People across political persuasions have a nerve that gets touched.
Why? What do you make of it? What is it?
I can't speak for everyone, but for myself, I think, you know, we all make compromises with our financial system.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're a Christian and you know that deep down you're not following the actual teachings of Jesus. Or maybe you're a liberal and you pay your taxes proudly, and yet when you see a homeless person, you walk to the other side of the street and you don't give them any money and you don't make eye contact. Because we've learned that you don't have to do that. And when we see someone who's proving that you can actually live without money, it makes us think, oh, wow, I've made some compromises and I don't actually live according to my own beliefs the way I thought I did. Mm. It's what it did for me anyway.
You write about the fact that in some way you were completely different from Daniel in this sense. You say you'd always really liked money. and I suppose most of us do, but you write about a particular kind of affection. Collecting,
right.
You know.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, you know, I had this grandmother who always gave me coins. And my brother and I would collect them and put them in the little tubes and roll them up and take them to the bank. And, you know, our passbook account savings would go from $13 to $17 to $21. And I loved it. Hmm. And even though I lived a really, what I thought of as an unmaterialistic life up into my 30s, I mean, all of my possessions could fit in the back of my truck for years. I still loved the game of saving money. I still loved the idea if I got something for cheap, then I was working the system, you know? I was winning. And I still do that. You know, if I go out and find a car that's $2,000 below Blue Book, I think it's great. And I love a lot of parts of capitalism.
Well, I guess it's pretty apparent, but talk about just how our lives are dependent on money, because you write about this in the book. You say our national identity is enmeshed with the idea of private property.
Yeah, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution says we can't be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. And, you know, placing property alongside life and liberty, that's amazing. That's a brand new invention in human civilization, or at least it's only a couple hundred years old. People and cultures survived without any concept of private property for thousands of years. I mean, when the white people showed up in America, the Indians didn't think you could own land any more than you could own the sunlight or the air. So this is a relatively new idea for humans, and yet here in America, we embrace it like a law of physics. If you fall off the roof, if you step off the roof, you'll fall to the ground. If you don't pay your taxes, if you don't pay your rent, you'll get evicted. You're not going to have an argument with your landlord or with a judge or with the sheriff who comes to evict you. End of story. You know, if you don't pay, you're out. So we accept that. And because we're so deep in it, I don't think we realize that there's another way of doing it.
I wanted to ask you about the moment that you so you walk away from Daniel, that first encounter where you see him again. When did you figure not only that you wanted to find him, talk to him, ask him questions, but maybe even write a book about him? I mean, how did that evolve?
Well, Daniel has been talking about the idea that money is an illusion for 12 years now, since 2000, when the economy was booming. And no one paid him any attention. Of course, you know, he lived in a cave. But after 2008, a lot of people said, hey, you know what? Maybe money is an illusion. I mean, trillions of dollars disappeared overnight. Let's say your house was worth $500,000 one day. The next day it was worth $300,000. And you said, God, well, what happened to that 200 grand that I had?
Yeah.
People's pensions disappeared. And so at that point, someone, a Moab writer named Christopher Ketchum, did a story about Suelo. And it was kind of I think the tagline was, "Could you think you're going to have to live without money? Well, here's someone who does."
Yeah.
And suddenly I started reading his blog, his website. I didn't realize at that point that Suelo had a blog or website. I hadn't talked to him in years, although we were Facebook friends. And I said, oh, my God, this guy has got some good points. And this guy has in some way been prophetic about the economy. He's been saying all along, you know, this money's not real. And so I said, you know, I think a lot of people are feeling this too, because all of a sudden, you know, we're out of work, our houses are worth less than we paid for them, and our pensions are worth nothing. So I went looking for him.
Let me ask you about, I want to have you read a section here in the book. Because you talk about what his life is like. He principally lives in these canyons. He finds these caves in canyon lands, and he lives there. And, of course, it's technically illegal to be doing that,
It's legal for 14 days.
14 days.
And then after that, it's illegal. You're supposed to move, I think, 30 miles away, which is hard if you don't have a car.
Here's a moment in the book where he has, I'm not sure if it's the first confrontation, but he has a confrontation with a ranger. And I think it just expresses sort of what his life is like and his reaction to, I guess, the realities of day-to-day life. You want to set this up for us at all, or is it pretty self-explanatory, you think?
I think it's self-explanatory. In the fall of 2002, 2 years after quitting money, Suelo homesteaded a majestic alcove high on a cliff, 200 feet across and 50 feet tall. Its sculpted mouth was windblown into smooth symmetry. Sitting inside and gazing into the gorge below felt like heralding himself to the world from inside the bell of a trumpet. Suelo's grotto was a two-hour walk from pavement, and believing he was unlikely to be disturbed, he settled in for the long haul. He chipped at the rocky ground to create a wide flat bed and lined it with tarps and pads and sleeping bags that had been left out with someone else's trash. He stacked rocks to block the wind and built wood-burning cook stoves from old tin cans. He learned to forage for cactus pods, yucca seeds, wildflowers, and the watercress that grew in the creek. From dumpsters, he stockpiled dry goods like rice and beans and flour and sealed them in plastic buckets. He drank from springs, bathed in the creek. He washed his clothing by wading it overnight with the river rock, dried it on the hot sandstone. He arranged on stone slabs a library of books. From a chunk of talus, he carved a statue, a ponderous head like some monolith from Easter Island. In warm months, the cave attracted occasional hikers, and when Suelo was away, he left a note. It said, "Feel free to camp here. What's mine is yours. Eat any of my food, read my books, take them with you if you'd like." Visitors left notes in return, saying they were pleased with his caretaking. Then one day, after several years of peace, a ranger from the Bureau of Land Management arrived to evict him. Suelo had long since violated the 14-day limit. "If I were hiking along here and I saw this camp," said the ranger, "I'd feel like I wasn't allowed here, that it was someone else's space. But this is public land." And Suelo said, Are you saying this because you're paid to say it or because you really believe it? Well, I do have to keep my personal and my professional opinions separated, said the ranger, but you are making a high impact here. Suelo said, who do you think is making a higher impact on the earth, you or me? The ranger wrote a ticket for $120. Well, I don't use money, Suelo said, so I can't pay this. Not only did he not use money, he had discarded his passport and driver's license. He had even discarded his legal surname, Schellenberger, in favor of Suelo, which is Spanish for soil. He chose the name spontaneously back in his tree-sitting days in Oregon when he caught sight of a sticker that said, all soil is sacred. Suelo has stuck.
It's Mark Sandy, and he's reading from his book, The Man Who Quit Money. So you mentioned how tempting it is to see Daniel as someone who is wanting to save the earth. That's why he's doing this. He wants to sort of decrease his footprint. But you say that's not really his primary mission.
No, before he quit money, he was already living with such a low footprint that in some ways this was an almost negligible difference. You know, when he still had a job and paid taxes and paid his student loans, he had decided to go off and live in these canyons just because he loved being outside and he was trying to pay off his student loans instead of paying rent. So, of course, having a low impact is part of it, but there's a much, I'd say, deeper reasons for doing it.
What? I mean, because it's the rejection of a system. That's what it's about, it seems.
Well, it's a rejection, but it's also an embrace. Ultimately, to him, this is a better way of life.
Rejection of one system and the embrace of another.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. To him, this is a way that is a more meaningful life, less anxious, less striving, less worrying about stuff and status. So I guess what he's rejected is our economic system. He thinks it's unfair and unjust. He has the same criticism of the Federal Reserve Bank that you'll hear from the Tea Party. He has the same criticism that our government is controlled by corporations that you'd hear from the Occupy movement. Mm. And his idea is direct civil disobedience. He's an absolute boycott. I mean, this is called freeganism by some people. Daniel doesn't really belong to any movement, but, you know, it's an absolute boycott. And what he's embraced, I would say, is a spiritual path that, you know, as a lifelong religious person who's studied all the scriptures of all the religions, he's determined that the teachings from Jesus to Buddha to Krishna to Muhammad to Gandhi and Thoreau is this idea of non-attachment or non-possession, that you give up some of the material world for a more satisfying spiritual life.
You write about one particular lapse he has. And a lot of people have reacted to this in the Atlantic piece, which is really interesting, and I wanted to ask you about it. So he gets $500 back on his taxes, and he gets invited to a friend's wedding in, was it Florida?
He was in Florida, and the wedding was here in Utah.
Back here in Utah. Okay. So he really – this seems so completely out of character. He splurges, pays the deposit on a Mercedes-Benz sports car.
Right.
A convertible.
Right.
And makes his way from Florida back here.
Right. So at this point, this was in 2001 – he had been without money for 6 months. And, you know, he had never made a vow that he was going to do this for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
It was an experiment.
Right.
And he'd done it for 6 months.
He calls it an experiment, an email he sent out to his friends. Which
absolutely.
Is
yeah. And after 6 months, he was on the East Coast living in an intentional community. And he got this tax refund for $500 that had been floating around. You know, he didn't have an address at that point. His parents had got it and they'd sent it to him. And so he said, you know what? Experiment's off for now. And what he did was this drive-away car program where some person has a car they want moved across the country. And, you know, it's basically a barter. You drive their car and they let you use the car. So he paid the $500. And I believe he got the $500 back when he safely delivered the car in Santa Fe or something like that. So the experiment was off and he still had the $500. He spent it all over the course of a couple months. And then he said, you know what? I liked it better without money. This money feels like a ball and chain. And he got rid of that, and he hasn't used any since.
That was the last time.
Yeah.
So if he uses the word experiment, I mean, that's how he was thinking about it at the time. It's not an experiment anymore. Or is it?
I think it is. He still doesn't make a vow that he's going to do it for the rest of his life.
Really?
Yeah. And he's been really influenced by Gandhi's book, Experiments with Truth. And so he sees everything as an experiment. And, you know, for him, this is all about freedom. Living without money feels like it's made him more free.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to make a vow or a promise that would curtail his freedom. So he's not. He doesn't say, I'm going to do this forever. You know, he might change his mind someday, but...
So in that way, he's not a monk.
Exactly, yeah. A monk typically makes a lifelong...
It's not a vow.
A lifelong vow of poverty. And no, he's not a monk, partially because he doesn't... perhaps you might say he wouldn't belong to any club that would accept him as a member.
He's
an independent, free spirit. But also, he doesn't want to sit on a mountaintop and attain enlightenment and let the world burn. He's really engaged in the world. That's why he has a blog. That's why he talks about this stuff. And, you know, he gets a lot of criticism, like these people you were talking about from online. You know, they say, well, if you're really free from the system, why don't you not use the internet? And that's not his thing. He's not trying to be self-sufficient. He's not trying to be independent from the system. He's simply trying to not use money. And as such, he's absolutely engaged in the politics down in southern Utah. He volunteers. He works. He sees friends. He hasn't given up much outside of money.
Yeah. Mark Sundin is with us. His book is called The Man Who Quit Money. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Mark Sundin. We're talking about his book, A Profile of Daniel Swalo. The book is called The Man Who Quit Money. In the book, Mark Sundin, you sort of trace the origins of this life philosophy. And it seems like one part of the understanding all of this is his upbringing. He's raised in a family of, you describe them as religious idealists. They're sort of religious fundamentalists.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're... Christian fundamentalists and the type who were actually doing missionary work and were really trying to follow the teachings of Jesus, you know, to the letter, converting people, leading Bible studies. And
very literal interpretation of the Bible.
And taking in poor people
who
need a place to sleep. They would bring them into the house. And a very idealistic interpretation of Christianity.
There's this... important moment in Daniel's life. He's young. His family is part of this congregation in this working class Denver neighborhood. 1969, you say it was on a Sunday. And Daniel sees this exchange between this couple in his church who had arrived in a Cadillac.
Right.
And this vagabond, this guy who walks by, the hippie, as they called him.
Right.
So tell that story.
Yes. Yeah, so this couple that in the Cadillac, I believe they had maybe donated one of the buildings to the church. They were very well off. And Daniel and his family, he had three brothers and a sister. They were getting out of their car. And as this hippie walked past, he said to this very rich couple, "You know, are you serving God or are you serving money?" And then he walked off. And this couple who were, you know, donated the building to the church, they were very offended. And... But Daniel, already at that young age, I think he was 8, he had already read the Bible. He knew about Jesus asking people to give up their possessions and that it was more difficult for a rich man to get into heaven than for a camel to squeeze through a needle.
Yeah.
I have a needle.
Yeah.
And so he said to his father, you know, who was that guy and why did he say that and was he right?
Right.
And his father said, oh, he's just a... He's just a hippie. He doesn't understand anything. He's just a heathen.
But it stayed with Daniel, that story.
It stuck with him over the years, yeah. And he, his entire life, I think, has been in some ways a struggle to understand some of Jesus' teachings in ways that didn't make sense to him from a very young age.
But he arrives at the at school, the University of Colorado in Boulder, 1981. You describe him. He hasn't changed his name, of course. And he votes for Reagan. He's a preppy who worked with the Campus Crusade for Christ.
Yeah, he penned an editorial for the newspaper talking about how communists were a great threat. He was a very, what nowadays is called the religious right.
He was a part of that. And he's studying the Bible in college, and you write about this thing where he strikes upon this idea, the concept of wisdom in the Old Testament. And he sees wisdom personified as a woman. And this gets him thinking, and it hits him, you write, that we're not supposed to focus on the dominant thing, but the recessive thing. So not the eagle, but the sky. Not the ship, but the seas. Not the man, but the maiden. What is that that he strikes upon?
Well, it's some might call it a feminist interpretation of Christianity. He at the time was also studying Taoism in his world religion classes, and he said, oh, this is actually kind of what they're talking about in Eastern religions, that it's, he always thought that Christianity was such a male-dominated religion. You have the Father and the Son, you have the Holy Ghost, and most of the biblical figures are men, and it's very patriarchal. And here he was finding something more like Taoism, like this idea that, it's not the pot, it's the vacancy inside of the pot. Mm-hmm. It's not the wheel, it's the spoke in the middle. And that just really got him thinking about that maybe what he'd been taught in Christianity wasn't not quite what he thought.
And then he meets a professor at the university, Brian Mahan, who has a really powerful influence on over Daniel. And his, as you write in the book, at this point, his fundamentalism is pretty rattled. What influence was Professor Mahan on the man he finally became, I guess?
Mahan was a Catholic, and he was interested in liberation theology, this idea that Jesus was a revolutionary who would have been at home in a social movement today, of the poor people fighting against the injustice of the ruling class. And so I'd say that Mahan opened his idea to the fact that maybe Christianity could be a social justice movement. Daniel said to me once, he said, but until then I never realized that you could be a Democrat and a Christian.
Wow. I wonder, I want to ask you about this moment that you write about. Daniel is driving in Mount Evans. It's the spring. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not sure if we need to set this up. I mean, the story itself sort of speaks for itself. You want to say something?
Yeah, I'll set it up a little bit. When he was discovering this feminine side of Christianity was at the same moment in his life where he was realizing he was gay.
Yeah.
And this was pretty hard to be a fundamentalist and come from a fundamentalist family. He went down to Ecuador, spent 2 years in the Peace Corps, finally came out to his family, and it was a really shattering event. Very difficult within his family, very difficult within his faith. And started to think of himself as an atheist for a brief period and fell into what he now recognizes as a clinical depression. So he was working as a social worker in Denver when this picks up. At 3 a.m, Suelo dresses and starts the sedan. He takes the highway into the Rockies, the same evergreen range where his father broke horses and quartered his mother. He exits at the Mount Evans Road and winds up into the mist. It's spring, and the asphalt is wet from the packs of dirty snow clinging to the mountainside. He knows his destination. He can picture it. The road narrows and grows steeper. Now, with the black night turning gray, he can see an icy lake so far below it looks like a puddle. His is the only car on the road. What kind of lunatic would be driving up Mount Evans at this hour, he thinks, and gets a laugh out of that. He steers to the precipice and peers over. A quick drop-off, then a steep slope of boulders, the tips of wild grasses poking through the snow, and the big free fall, hundreds of feet down to the lake. He makes a note of the spot. The shoulder is crumbling into the abyss, and steel girders prop it up. He drives to the pullout and turns around, preparing for a final approach. His heart leaps to his throat. And then, as he points the wheel toward the edge, something emerges from the fog. It's an animal. Two, three, more. Is he hallucinating? No, it's a herd of mountain goats, with their knobby knees and white fur and spiked horns. The goats have descended the slope opposite the drop-off and are making their way up the road. One approaches the car. Daniel rolls down the window. Man and beast look into each other's eyes. The goat has wet, black, compassionate eyes, two saucers of oil. And Daniel feels oddly comforted, as if the animal has given him permission to do what he's about to do. He punches the gas. The car jerks toward the cliff. Daniel thinks, if God has some purpose for me, then not even I can resist it. The rocks scrape beneath as he launches, then blackness.
It's a dramatic moment, of course, but you say the crash assumes an almost supernatural importance for Daniel. And his life, and this is how you put it in the book, begins to resemble an ordered fable. What do you mean?
Well, as I was working on this book, I started reading Joseph Campbell and The Hero with a Thousand Faces Thinking about this idea of the heroic journey, because I couldn't really make sense of Daniel's life in terms of economics or politics or even modern-day religion. And I'm thinking, like, this is a guy that goes out into the desert, gives away all his possessions, lives in a cave, goes against everything in society that we've come to believe. And furthermore, there's this event where he attempts suicide, and then by what would seem to be a miracle,
finds
himself back at the top of the cliff. The car tumbles a couple hundred feet down, lodges up against a rock at the very edge of the precipice. And he's saved. And Daniel, I asked him about this, and he said, it was the first time I felt the hand of God, and I hated it. Because he had thought that he could get out of this life. You know, this life didn't work for him, and he was going to get out of it. And to him, this was God telling him, oh, no, you don't. You know, you got to make sense of it while you're still alive. And that was in 1990 or 91. So it took him 10 years from that point to where he gave up money. But that was, where it began. That was where I like to say his hero's journey began, that he said, okay, here's what I need to do. I need to find meaning in life. And he went out and he found it.
Mark Sindine, his book is called The Man Who Quit Money. You can learn more about the book and visit Daniel Swalo's blog at our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Mark Sindine. He's the author of the book, The Man Who Quit Money. He's joining us here in the studio. And also with us in the studio now is Daniel Swalo, the subject of Mark's new book. Daniel Swalo, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I wanted to ask a lot of questions, obviously. But the first one I was getting at was, human beings have always exchanged things, you know, given one thing for another thing. You know, in another time we bartered, you know, grain for in exchange for something. And I'm wondering what's wrong with the money system? It's, you know, it's, in some ways it's just another kind of barter system. Maybe it's more sophisticated, but what has changed, do you think, that makes it corrupt?
Well, I don't really necessarily believe money itself is evil. And I kind of feel like it's part of our evolution, something we have to go through. But I envision it going obsolete. It's something we have to move away from. But part of another thing that motivated me to live without money was just observing nature and how this infinite universe functions without money, and how does it function without money. And we believe that our money system is the universe, and we can't imagine, we don't allow our minds to think outside this little box. It's actually quite small compared to the infinite universe. And just like observing, like anything, like you take fruit from a tree, like an apple from a tree, the tree demands nothing back. So how does this tree get what it needs back? The point is it doesn't worry, and you don't worry. You don't have any sense of obligation taking the fruit. The tree has no sense of its consciousness of credit and debt. Yeah. Neither I or the tree has consciousness of credit and debt. And it's when we start worrying about the balance, the natural balance of positive and negative of nature, like nature takes care of it.
Right.
Every positive is going to be met with a negative and vice versa. So right. Why do we think we have to control it? And this is the way the money system works. It's a lack of faith in this process of nature. And if we look at, if we just look around us, we can see the evidence. We see that no commercial civilization on Earth knows how to balance its budget, even with our PhD economists. And yet nature is balanced. Why is it balanced? And you don't see any two animals with this idea of, okay, I'm going to give you this if you give me that.
Right.
It happens naturally, like barter happens naturally, but nobody's conscious of it. And to me, this goes to the core of the teachings of all the world religions, that you give expecting nothing in return. And the idea that God controls credit and debt, like vengeance is mine, I will repay.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't think about this stuff, but this is actually the core of our spiritual traditions, which few of us think about.
It's not faith. Is it faith?
Yeah, it's exactly faith. Like, I feel like everything in nature runs on faith.
Yeah.
And faith to me isn't a belief system. It's a trust. It's a trust in the cycles of nature.
And completely then submitting to it, just giving into it completely.
Yeah, that's submission, which in Arabic is Islam. It's total submission to, you trust that everything you need is going to come when you need it, whether it's good or bad. It's like you accept it. And this is what animals and nature do, and plants, and air, everything.
It's interesting. I wonder if do you give yourself certain rules? I mean, you say I'm not going to accept money. I'm not going to do that. But do you impose certain rules on your existence, or do you try to be more sort of free flowing in the way you live? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's more free flowing, but I do find myself putting rules on myself, and I almost feel like the rules are a little doorway out of the rules, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain it, but it's like...
That's the point, right? It's hard to explain.
Yeah, it's like my rule is to live free, basically.
But let me ask you this. What stresses you out?
Not really that much. Sometimes I find myself worrying about what people are thinking. And I think that's bottom line, our biggest obstacle. Why, like, just not following our hearts. I feel like that's what life is about, and we end up following somebody else's idea or ideas in our head. I don't know, like with the publicity that's come up, I sometimes find myself stressing about that, like, wow, now I have to live up to something, when the idea is just to do whatever, be myself.
Yeah, now you're an icon, right? I mean, now you are, like it's interesting because the way Mark writes about your, the way you were thinking about religion, that they, in any faith, that people had taken Jesus, for example, and taking him out of reality, I think is how Mark puts it, that he got from you, and made him a thing, right? And now you're a thing.
Yeah, 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 exactly. It's like, yeah, this is the point. Like, I feel like money, and this is why I don't say money is evil necessarily, because it's the same as language. It symbolizes something else.
Yeah.
It doesn't symbolize itself. And this, the idea of idolatry, we create images in our heads or ideas, and then we start revering or hating ideas rather than reality. This is kind of how I started feeling better about, like, negative comments that people that didn't even know me were making. Like, they just have this idea that they're hating. Like, I feel like if all of us just saw reality and we saw each other as we are, instead of this idea, then a lot of conflict that we see in the world would not exist. You know, you see that in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Like, the idea was to make the Jews into this horrific monster, and then people could hate them. But if they actually saw them for who they are, humans, then I feel like it's impossible for one human to hate another. But we hate ideas. And if the flip side is worship, they're like two ends of the spectrum or a swinging pendulum. It's like we worship an idea rather than a person. So we might revere what we think is a person, but it's an icon, that's idea. And that's what we do with religious figures. Like, that's why people don't practice Jesus' teachings, is because they're worshiping an icon rather than actually seeing a human being there, an icon in heaven.
You pushed the accelerator pedal on that car, and then you survived. And, you know, it seems miraculous that you did. But Mark Sundin explains in the book that you don't really see it as a miracle. So how do you explain what happened? You got lucky.
Well, I don't see it as a miracle in the way that we think of miracles.
Like God's hand coming down and
the idea is that I see everything as a miracle. There's nothing that's more miraculous than another thing. Like, everything is. And we have this idea that this is a miracle and this is not. This is mundane and this is sacred or whatever. But I feel like it's all God, or
it's all, astounding,
yeah,
right?
It's all the, yeah. Yeah, and that was no more miraculous than waking up in the morning, in my eyes. It's just, but I'm not saying that's not a miracle.
Yeah. Mark Sundin, let me ask you. It's like, what's interesting about Daniel here, we're going to talk about you right in front of you, Daniel, but is he's... You get this kind of mythic impression then of Daniel in some ways, and then he'll do something that throws you off. And you write about there are a couple of moments. I mean, he'll break the mood with a joke, or there's one particular thing where I'm starting to think in my mind as I'm reading this book that he's this, you know, ascetic who only – and he does have – you know, doesn't eat very much. I mean, that's sort of part of his belief, I suppose. But then he offers you a gummy bear. You know what I mean?
Right.
To talk about that, because that he's not what you expect, I guess.
Right. One of my favorite lines in the book is something that a story that Daniel related, where I believe it was he was debating a Christian, and she said, what, you think you can live like Jesus? And he said, well, yeah, don't you? Isn't that the point of being a Christian? And I think what's interesting is that, yeah, we put these religious figures onto a pedestal and worship them as if they're absolutely pure. But of course, these people also walked on earth, and they were human beings. And so, you know, Daniel never claims to be the Messiah or to be like Jesus or to be a prophet or to be enlightened, anything like that. But here's someone who's actually taking these things seriously, these ideas seriously, and it blows people away and they think, oh my gosh, he must be an avatar or something like that. But he's not. He's just this guy that lives in a cave and eats gummy bears, you know? And he's living a life that's actually absolutely committed to religious ideals, but that doesn't make him something other than a human being.
Yeah. Kathleen is joining us on the line from Salt Lake City. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have to say, this is a wonderful show. Anyway, I wanted to speak directly to questions of family and friends. Just from the beginning of the show, I have a father whose teeth are falling out. I get on the phone with him. He says, yeah, I pulled out two today, Kathy. And then a brother who's a monk in Tassajara and, you know, wonderful, having a wonderful time there. I mean, it's very, very happy. And I find myself getting more upset about the teeth than, you know, it's just life. But I'm wondering how family have dealt with this now that, you know, it's been many years since you came out to them and, you've been living this lifestyle. And, I mean, I think it's beautiful. And I think what you're saying is beautiful about everything being miraculous. I believe that, too. So I think what you're doing is wonderful. But can you speak more to your community? You obviously are doing a blog and Facebook, but that's a virtual community, you know? So where, how much face-to-face do you get with friends and your work? Thanks so much.
Kathleen, thanks.
Well, when I first started doing this, I was more of a hermit. I spent more time up in the canyon.
Why? Was it harder to be with people, or you just wanted to, was that part of the experiment, being alone?
Yeah, it's just something I wanted to do because I felt I wanted to understand nature more perfectly. Yeah. And yeah, I don't really know why. That's just what I did.
Sure.
And then as time went on, I spent more time in town. Like now I feel like I'm a total townie. I kind of miss the staying up in the cave for long periods. I'll stay up there a night or two, and then I have another camp near town. But I really do like hanging out with friends, and I feel like ultimately this is about community. And ultimately, it's about face-to-face community, and I have to catch myself because I start putting more importance on the blog and website than I do on just face-to-face things, because I feel like these things, like basically bottom line, life is about loving our neighbor as ourself, but we're loving everybody but our neighbor. You know, we love people overseas. We love political figures or religious or whatever. We love
people at a distance.
Yeah, or Facebook or whatever. And it's removing us from each other.
We should mention Mark Sundin, as you do in the book. I mean, the book, a good part of the book is about Daniel's relationship with his family. And he maintains a good relationship with them. They quibble about theological things, of course, but you talk about how I love this. They've said that Daniel has taken the Bible and spiritualized it.
Right, and I think you have to be someone who spends a lot of time debating theology to understand that that's a bad thing, to spiritualize the Bible from a certain perspective. But what surprised me most, I think, before I met Daniel's parents, was I'd assume that since they were conservatives that they'd be really disappointed and perhaps ashamed of having a son who decided to be homeless and not have a job. And as I got to know them, I realized that when you live a life that's so close to the Bible and thinking about it literally, this idea of going off and eating locusts and honey and getting rid of your possessions and going into the desert, it's not all that strange. And so for my family, for instance, where I was more concerned with getting into a good college and being a success and sort of fulfilling my potential, that would have been far more foreign.
Let me ask you this finally, Daniel, to you. We don't have much time left, about 30 seconds or so. Do you feel like this experiment will end at some point, that you've accomplished what you want to, and you could go back to money having accomplished that? Or do you think it's forever?
Well, I don't envision going back to money. The idea seems absurd to me, but I haven't made any vows. But yeah, I don't see any reason why I would go back.
Well, Daniel Suelo, we wish you the best. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being with us. Mark Sandin is the author of the book, The Man Who Quit Money. Thank you all very much, Mark. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.